It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Renee Ritchie is not here, but good news, Lori Gill, his compadre at iMore.com, is, along with Alex Lindsay and Andy Iannotko. We've got some more thoughts on WWDC, and we decided to talk to a developer. Rich Siegel from Barebones Software will be here to explain why he's coming back to the Mac App Store. That's all up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 614, recorded Tuesday, June 12th, 2018. 3D, don't lie. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Gazelle, the online marketplace for buying and selling used devices. Shop from a variety of certified pre-owned electronics or trade one in for cash. Give new life to a used device at gazelle.com today. And by Eero. Never think about Wi-Fi again with Eero's hyper-fast, super simple Wi-Fi system. And now the second generation Eero is tri-band and twice as fast. For free overnight shipping to the U.S. or Canada, visit EERO.com, select overnight shipping at checkout, and enter the code MACBREAK. And by WordPress. Reach more customers when you build your business website on WordPress.com. Plans start at $4 a month. Get 15% off any new plan purchase at WordPress.com/MACBREAK. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Apple. We got a great panel for you. Let me introduce the regulars, and then we'll talk to a special guest joining us today. Andy Iannotko's here from Iannotko.com. Great to have you, sir.
Great to be a Tuesday again and be talking to you.
He apparently is now, I guess you're going to announce your new gig at the Hayward Fire Department.
It turns out they were still using like HTML 1.2 for their website, so I got them into a new site design that involves tables.
Very nice. Very and iframes, always good.
Well, I couldn't sell them on that, but I did have them get to that JavaScript thing. So then, when you like put your mouse over like a box, it turns a different color. Baby steps.
Ooh,
you
know, Ajax, baby.
The plus side is like there is zero dependency, so it's not as though I'm committing them to a whole bunch of third party frameworks that nobody documents. So.
Also, the man of the Pixel Core's man of the hour, Mr. Alex Lindsay, Alex Lindsay on Twitter. Hi, Alex. Nice to see you. We got to turn Alex's mic on, though, if he's going to join the show. Just a minor detail. Can we hear him now?
Hello.
Oh, only if you say something.
Yes.
Great to see you.
Good to see you, too.
And Renee Ritchie was going to be on the show, but he missed his flight, right? So, good news. We got somebody better. Lori Gill, Deputy Managing Editor at iMore. Lori joined Renee Ritchie and Serenity Caldwell at the WWDC. But you have a unique perspective because you were at both WWDC and Google I.O.
I have lots to say.
I think that's very interesting. But I want to introduce our special guest, a guy we love and know and we've had on before, Rich Siegel. He is the guy in charge at Barebones Software, barebones.com, creator of the single most useful program on every Macintosh, BB Edit. Hi, Rich. Good to see you.
Hi, Leo. It's good to be here.
Your ears are probably burning at WWDC because they mentioned BB Edit. And my jaw dropped in the context. They mentioned Panic Transmit and Barebones BB Edit would be on the App Store with the new Mojave.
That's so right.
I thought we have to get Rich on. Please don't. I know you've got to be politic and, you know, you got to be nice to Apple, but you had very famously said we can't be on the App Store with BB Edit.
So back in October 2014, I think it was, we got to this decision where we looked at sort of what it took to be in the App Store and it and the changes we had to make to the product and the way we had to have really sort of two different products for one for App Store customers and one for not App Store customers. And at the time, we reached the decision that it just wasn't a good fit for us. And time passed. We've had a lot of conversations with Apple, and now we're at that place where we feel like they're hearing us. They feel like they have heard us, and we feel like they are pushing the technology forward. So now we sort of got to the place where we said, oh, okay, it looks like we can now be in the App Store, and we can sell direct, and we can sell the same product to both customers, both sets of customers, and everybody wins. So that's where we ended up.
There are two negatives there's several probably, but two big negatives to being in the App Store developers talk about. There's a technical negative and there's a commercial negative. One of the negatives is you don't have a direct relationship with your customers anymore. It's intermediated through Apple. I mean, they take 30%. That, you know, maybe you get the value for that, but in a larger way, you don't get access to them.
That's right. Apple keeps their customer information very close at hand. Developers who sell in the App Store don't know who the customer is unless the customer reaches out to us, as of course they can do anytime for assistance. And that challenge is still there for us. There's really nothing we can do about it. Apple knows how we feel about it, and we've said kind of all we can. So that issue is still there. We're going to live with it.
Yeah. All right. And it maybe is worth living with it because especially if you get featured at WWC keynote or you're featured in the App Store, they're going to have more editorial stuff in the App Store. So there'll be more opportunities to be featured. It's a great way to let people know about what you do. So maybe it's a good way to build your sales, even if you don't get the email addresses of your customers. The second issue, though, is a technical issue, and that has to do with the sandbox, the limitations that App Store apps have on. Now, I can understand why Panic said we can't do an FTP program because we don't get access to the file system. But I got the sense that this in Mojave, this is going to change.
So access to the file system for sandboxed applications has always been sort of a very fluid notion. when you're in a sandbox, you certainly don't get unrestricted access to the file system. And the security folks at Apple, they're very clear on this. The notion is not so much that they don't want apps doing anything. It's just that they're very conscious about wanting to protect the user's data. So there are ways that you can request access to parts of the file system outside of the sandbox. There are mechanisms that you can use and that are supported. For 1014, you can request certain, what they're called entitlements, in which your application is allowed to look in certain places. So the technology has advanced to the point there where, again, for 1014, we can address a lot of those issues head on and then have an application that our users can use. They can read the file system. They can do multi-file search and replace operations. You know, it'll be fully functional.
Will the command line features of BBEdit be functional as well? I love the fact that I have a worksheet that can be the bash shell. And it's kind of like the old Mac Programmer's Workshop where you can see previous commands. You get it all. I love that. You can edit them. Will that also be functional?
Yeah, absolutely. That's an essential part of the plan is to have the product that is completely and fully functional for both App Store and not App Store.
So there won't be a difference between BBEdit, whether you buy it in the App Store or you buy it direct from Barebones.
Yeah, that's right. That's the plan. That's the intention. We do have a lot to go, a lot of time between now and when Mojave ships, and the details, of course, some of them still need to be flattened out technologically, and we have a great deal of work and testing to do. But yeah, that's the plan. Apple and we and Apple are. We share an understanding of that plan, and this is a plan that's going to happen.
The other thing, and you know, I'm not a macOS developer, so you'll have to correct me if I'm saying something dumb. My understanding is that an application, when it's installed on macOS, has to request entitlements, the ability to do certain things. And by the way, I'm not against any of this. I completely understand Apple's point of view here. It does enhance security. It's appropriate to sandbox applications, and as long as you could still buy apps direct from the developer, and not through the App Store. It doesn't hinder anybody on the Macintosh who wants to do something with more capability. I like buying stuff in the App Store. I like the notion of the security it provides, and I would like to see more apps like BB Edit available in the App Store. Do they change the entitlements?
So the notion of entitlements is entitlements are also almost like a programming language. So you can write whatever entitlements you like, and then the question is, are you allowed to use those entitlements for an app that is sold through the App Store? So really there are two sides to the issue here. One of them is technological and the other is a matter of policy. So you can write entitlements that allow your application to do whatever you think it should. And then once you've tested that and made sure it works, then you need to get review permission from AppReview to use them. And so that is one of those, as I said, it's a bifurcated issue. So we can request entitlements to do certain things. We have a reasonable expectation based on being able to justify those entitlements that we'll be allowed to have those entitlements in the App Store.
Okay. So it is conceivable that when the rubber hits the road, and you submit your app and you've requested these entitlements, of course, that are in the app that you get directly from Barebones, that Apple may say, no, you can't. But you've had the conversations that give you the expectation that they'll say, yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
What are the sticking points? What are the things that you couldn't do before that you'll be able to do now?
Well, the biggest thing that we couldn't do before was any operation that requested administrative privileges. For example, installing the command line tools that you could use to run BB Edit. The ability to open or save files that you don't normally have permission to open or save. And we're having conversations with Apple about those issues. But again, what the feeling we've got is they understand our requirement to have this fully functional product. They understand that we are not willing to sacrifice features in the name of being in the App Store. And so their position is, instead of saying you can't do that and then putting us in the position of having to work around it, which is kind of where we were a few years ago, now our sense is what we're feeling is from Apple is, let's figure out how to make this work.
Wow. Well, they of all the developers, you and Panic are in the best situation because they've already pre-announced the availability. So there's a lot of incentive for them to make this work for you. But I gather that if it doesn't have 100% functionality equivalence between your direct sale product and the Mac App Store product, you won't do it.
I think if we see that there isn't 100% equivalence, they're going to figure out how to get us there.
Good.
Guys, that's how we're looking at it, and as far as we can sense, that's how our contacts at Apple are looking at it as well.
Good. I've been monopolizing Rich. Andy, I know you and Rich are friends. You hang out at the diner together, drinking your coffee milk.
It's widely known that we never talk.
You just sit in the diner together. You stare at each other
anything.
And drink your coffee.
But if anybody, Lori, Andy, Alex, if you have any questions for Rich, I don't want to monopolize. I am monopolizing, but I'm going to stop now.
You ended up asking the questions that I was thinking about asking. So I think I feel good. I think I understand what you're going for. I'm actually excited about the process that you're going to go through with Apple over the next few months, because I'm not saying that Apple made promises to you, but let's just say Apple made some promises to you and you're not going to budge. And that means that they're going to have to figure out how to make this work for you, which is, you're basically the trailblazer for other developers who have left the App Store. And your experience with Apple right now is going to be what all other app developers for Mac apps are going to kind of look to decide whether or not this is something they're willing to go through. So it's going to be an exciting process. Do you blog about the process? Of course, I know there's some things you have to keep secret.
I don't generally write online terribly much. And indeed, you're right. There are things that we can't talk about, stuff that is either up in the air or unreleased in the OS. And they have... Their NDAs are Very interesting. You mentioned my ears burning. It turns out that if you even think about talking about certain aspects that might be covered by the NDA, your ears start burning.
How are your ears right now? Are they okay?
Yeah. So there's a great deal. There's a great deal that I can't talk about.
Yeah.
But it's not dark stuff. It's more a matter of, you know, work that is ongoing and that they would prefer to disclose themselves once the job is done.
I'm just glad to see the reunification of the North and the South and the denuclearization of this relationship. I think it's a good thing all around.
I agree.
Favorite apps come from the App Store. Come from the App Store.
But there's a huge convenience with the App Store, right? So you get a new Mac.
When the Mac App Store came out, was it, I think, 2011, I was so excited. This was going to be the greatest thing. And it just was kind of meh. And the best apps, no offense to all the people who have apps in the App Store, because there's a lot of amazing ones. But some of my favorites you can't get in the Mac App Store. And the interface of the Mac App Store was also just kind of not very interesting and not easy to discover. So this whole thing is actually a wonderful thing for consumers of Mac apps as well as developers of Mac apps.
I just like what it says about it would have been disappointing if both Panic and Barebones had left the Mac App Store and just simply went their separate ways. When I heard about Panic and BBEdit coming back to the App Store, it really made me happy because I imagined it meant that it wasn't like Apple said, "Great, here's your hat. Go to hell. Fine. Go and stay with outside the App Store." The fact that they came back meant that there must have been ongoing changes at the App Store. We hear a lot about how the new management of the App Store seems to be more open to solving problems as opposed to just dropping a rule book and walking off from it. So I like it's good to see vibrancy and change happen and in a positive way.
I guess one other feature that maybe is important to you, the subscription. I mean, there are other features of the App Store we think are going to be changing. Maybe demos, I don't know, maybe subscription features, things like that. Are there other features, Rich, that you're happy to see that will be beneficial to you?
Well, I think the biggest one is what Lori touched on before, in which the visibility is the interface in the App Store is improving. The visibility of products and the discoverability of products looks like it's going to get on par with the iOS App Store. It looks like the same ideas are coming across from iOS. Yeah. And I think for us, that's going to be really great. Just the ability for people to find the product organically on their own without being pointed at it is going to be pretty big for us.
I can see that Bruno agrees with you.
Indeed.
Yeah, can we talk about the parrot in the room here?
Yeah, sorry about that interruption.
We love Bruno.
He's great. He's very determined.
Is he molting?
He's a little bit of a picker.
Uh-oh.
He's actually, believe it or not, in the process of regrowing.
You got to get a little beak mitten to keep him from picking at himself. Yeah, the Transmit guys, Panic Software, said that they're going to do subscription on the App Store and outright purchase on the web. Have you looked at something like that?
So we're looking into the options, and we haven't made any final decisions, and we're going to be announcing all of that as soon as we actually have something ready to ship.
Good.
So yeah, as far as the business side of it, that is, you know, an important piece of it is we can look at this now and say, okay, there's a viable ongoing business model here. Let's figure out how to fit it into what we have. So, yeah, nothing for us to announce yet. But as soon as we have software ready to ship, we'll be talking about pricing and licensing models and that sort of thing.
And I think it's great. I do have large, you know, I mean, specific applications that I use that are not in the App Store. But probably 95% of what I use at this point is all in the App Store.
It's a convenience.
It's just when I get a new computer, you know, or I go to another computer and I need to pull something down, that becomes the thing that is just super useful.
My trepidations about the App Store mostly have been laid to rest, which was that Apple was eventually going to require everything be sold through the App Store. And I was really worried that I would no longer be able to put arbitrary software on my Macintosh. I mean, I like the idea that for most people they can say, I'm going to use only the App Store, make gatekeepers say only App Store apps and be more secure, have more trusted apps. But for me, the reason I have a computer as opposed to an iPad is I want to be able to install whatever the hell I want to install on there. So I was worried. They have talked a little bit about changing the gatekeeper rules and requiring a certificate. Is that right, Rich?
There are some developments that are ongoing for Mojave. I don't remember what they spoke about, what they've disclosed publicly about notarized applications.
Notarized, that's the word,
And that's a slightly different model from the usual code signing. Prefacing what I'm about to say with, this is pure conjecture on my part, I can imagine a day in the future, and I don't think it's this year, it might not even be next year, I don't know when, but I can imagine a time when macOS by default won't run anything that isn't signed in some way.
Right.
Either you have built it yourself with a valid developer certificate, and those are easy to get from Apple, or you've downloaded it and you're using a trusted developer ID or notarized application, or it came from the App Store.
State of the Union talk, which we did not broadcast and I did not watch, they did talk specifically about this. So you're not speaking out of school when you say this. This was public knowledge.
Yep.
It said that apps will need express user consent for all API and direct access to things like mail database, message history, Safari data, Time Machine backups, iTunes device backups, locations or routines, system cookies, microphone, camera. That all makes sense. That's a good security model. As long as it doesn't keep third-party developers like you from offering full-powered programs without Apple's, express written consent.
Well, I think the sort of the natural conclusion here is that as part of an ongoing process, and I'd say beginning with 10.14, Apple has gotten the technology to the point where they can make sandboxing and security restrictions generally work in such a way that you can ship a product, we can ship a product that satisfies their security requirements and satisfies our requirements to produce a full product experience.
Good.
So, and we're a pretty low level tool. There are others that are even lower level, things like Super Duper. And I think that Apple realizes the need to still support a rich software ecosystem. They can't simply deny certain classes of product just because they don't fit cleanly into a security model. They've got to figure out how to make the security model work for everybody.
So the notarization thing you mentioned, Apple said, will be purely a malware scan. They're not gonna review the app in any other way, but they're gonna malware scan it before it gets notarized, and you won't be able. The presumption is you won't be able on Mojave. Maybe you'll be able to jump through hoops and install non-notarized apps, or maybe not. But the Mojave will really kind of require notarized apps. I don't think that's a onerous as long as they do that, and they don't start scanning for, I mean, it depends what they call malware. Is a Bitcoin miner malware? I don't know.
Sorry, go ahead, Andy.
I was just going to say, I have no problem with that so long as people still have the ability to write and publish whatever damn app they want without it being approved by Apple in some fashion. The more I talk to people about notarization, it's less about control of the content and more about just the idea of, if there is something bad out there, Apple wants to have the ability to basically pull that app from being able to be run. So long as that really is the thing, so long as someone can write the most offensive, horrible, problematic app that doesn't actually interfere with the operation of the user's computer or anybody else's, so long as there's still that ability, I'm fine with it.
Well, Leo really touches on something here when he talks about Bitcoin mining. If, for example, you know, how does Apple define malware? You know, there's a lot of, I don't know how Bitcoin mining works really, but I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who have that installed on their computers. And if Apple actually makes it so that that gets pulled off your Mac, you know, how is that going to be addressed? So there's something to be considered when you think about, you know, this notarization. Did I say that right? Notarization, yep. of Mac apps.
Yeah. So we just have to wait and see. I mean, I was relieved. That was my whole fear with the Mac App Store, and I was relieved that that didn't have that. And Rich was able to sell BB Edit through, you know, his website direct and continue to do so. And Rich, would you prefer people buy? Okay, now here's a loaded question. You can defer this if you want. Would you prefer people buy it direct from you?
In some ways, yes, because we like to know who our customers are. You know, a big part of our way of business for the past 25 years is to have built a strong and ongoing relationship with the customer. And buying direct from us helps us do that. On the other hand, we've always tried to support the customer having whatever choices they want to have. And so if it suits the customer to buy from the Mac App Store, they're still our customer. We're going to treat them just the same. So.
Yeah.
You know, if I want to balance it off, it's really hard to say. There are pros and cons.
Do the benefits of the App Store outweigh the 30% cut?
Again, some ways yes. Again, some ways no.
Right.
I think the biggest benefit is that for a certain range of our customers, the App Store installation experience is just so frictionless. For those customers, it eliminates any tech support questions about installation or update because it just happens.
So that saves you money right there. Yeah.
In a sense, yeah.
Yeah. And when I download it from the App Store, I'm downloading it from Apple through their Akamai network, not from you at all.
That's correct.
Yeah. And how has it been for, well, you don't know yet. I'll have to ask somebody else. Updates. some developers have complained certainly on iOS, about the difficulty of the gatekeeping slows down the update process. Are you concerned at all about that?
Not as much as we used to be. From what I've seen lately, the experience of a few other folks that I'm friends with, app review turn times are down to a day or less.
Good. Okay.
And so that sort of fits with our own process pretty well. When there's a deterministic amount of time for app review and it's a very short deterministic amount of time, that makes it much, much easier for us to plan our update release timing.
Very good. Any other questions for Mr. Siegel, or can we let him get back to work on BB Edit? Get to work, Rich. I'm sure there's
How's your driving? Have you burned through this year's set of tires yet, or
almost the rear tires are down to the second set of wear bars, and the fronts are fronts might need replacement by the end of the season.
Last time,
but fortunately, they're my autocross stickies, my regular street tires. They'll last for years.
Last time Rich was on, didn't you recommend some sort of device for pulling the engine or something, lifting your car off the ground? I can't remember.
Oh, you know, I think I did. I think it was the jack points. Yep.
Yep.
Still use them. They're still awesome.
Rich, you're the greatest. I love Bare Bones Edit, and I will continue to buy BB Edit as long as you continue to update it. Version 12 is the current version. I just got a copy of Yojimbo, your database program. Just keep up the good work. I really appreciate all you're doing. Are you considering shifting the code base to Swift at any point?
Not in the sense of, am I going to sit down and start rewriting everything? I think the answer to that is no. For us right now, Objective-C and Objective-C++ are good tools for what we need. Someday I'll pick up Swift and start writing new code in it and start fitting that into what we have.
Yeah. BB Edit is the second program I install on every Mac.
Of course, that begs the question.
Well, I put LastPass on first, so I can unlock.
The Finder is there first. Else.
Finder's there. Yeah, I'm Finder's there. Probably Chrome and LastPass and uBlock Origin are the next step, and then I download BBEdit. Thank you, Rich Siegel. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It's been a blast.
So good. Well, it's great to get the inside story too. Barebones.com. Go buy BBEdit. At least download the trial. At Siegel on the Twitter. Take care, Rich.
Thanks.
We'll take a break. There's still lots to talk about, and we have a great panel. Thank you for letting me, guys, monopolize Rich a little bit. Andy Anacco, Alex Lindsay, Lori Gill. Our show is timely because you may be looking at a new phone soon, and I just want to let you know what to do with the old phone when that time comes. Trade in your old device for a great price at Gazelle. You know by now, I've been talking about Gazelle for years. Gazelle.com accepts Samsung Galaxy S9, iPhone 8. Yes, you can trade it in an iPhone 10. I know more than a few people who have traded in the iPhone 10 because they wanted the fingerprint reader and they wanted a headphone jack, right? And they've gone back to the iPhone 7. You could actually do that.
I've heard of people like that.
I've heard of people like that. Gazelle's the place. If you're looking to buy a certified pre-owned device, they have an incredible selection. iPhones 6 through 10. For iPads, they've got standard Air, Mini, and Pro models. For laptops, MacBook Air and the Pro selection. They even cater to Android users with a variety of Samsung Galaxy phones. And every device fully inspected. They have a 30-point checklist of things, inspection that they go through to make sure everything's in working order. Everything, you know, of course functional, but also whether there's scratches. And you can choose your device at good, fair, or excellent condition. And the price matches, you know. If you don't mind a little gentle wear and tear, especially if you're replacing a used device, you know, maybe you lost your phone or it broke, that's a great way to save money. And it works fully. It's just, you know, it looks like it's been gently used. That's fine, right? Everything works for all the major carriers, AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, and Sprint. You can get unlocked devices there as well. But, of course, as always, everything you get was sold without a carrier contract. And you can get financing with Affirm. Just provide your basic information, and you'll get instantly approved. You can pay off in 3, 6, or 12 months. Easy monthly payments can be made through bank transfer, check, or debit card. All you got to do is, as you're checking out, just click the box that says financing with Affirm, GAZELLE.com. To buy or to sell, it's always Gazelle, right? Give new life to used devices. Trade it in for cash or buy a certified pre-owned device or do both, which I think is what a lot of people do. Trade in the iPhone 10 and get an iPhone 7. You could do it all at Gazelle. Gazelle.com. You'll get started today. And you have to say, we always, because we go through a lot of devices, we always sell it at Gazelle. And I'm always impressed by the quality of the service we get from them. And it's not unusual for them to say, oh, we quoted you $30. It's worth $40. Very frequently that happens, which is nice. They don't have to do that, but they do. Gazelle.com. We thank them for their longtime support of Mac Break Weekly. Okay. We're done. I am really glad we could get Rich on because I was really interested when Apple... I was sitting here and Apple said, and Panic Software's Transmit and Barebones BBEdit will be on the App Store. I was like stunned.
You're looking for flying pigs, weren't you?
Yeah. It's like, what?
One of the reasons why I love that is that we all love Barebones Software. We all love Rich and everybody else at Barebones. And the fact that Apple decided, it's very, very telling that Apple decided that we will look very, very good in front of these 6,000 developers if we say that Panics and Barebones are rejoining the App Store. So it wasn't like, oh, that's nice, what a nice thing for Barebones, but it's like the fact that the stature of the developers of Panics and the stature of the developers of Barebones, that 6,000 developers saying, oh, I guess things must be on an up curve at the App Store if these folks who not only pulled out of the App Store but left behind blog posts that stated in very, very simple, rational, and helpful ways their reasons behind it. That's a good sign for everybody.
You know, I forgot to ask him the most important question, if he's going to support dark mode. I bet he is.
Got to.
Alex, are you like over the moon? We all speculated that Alex. I said,
oh, yeah.
Dark mode is for Alex Lindsay and his comments.
Yeah, they're like, you can turn it off. And I'm like, why would you ever do that? Like, you know, like, just
photographers like, want that 30, yeah. What is it, 20, 30% gray background. Because that's how you'd photo edit, right?
Everything. Well, color pops out much better when everything's dark and gray. And so you just, especially if you're more image driven, it allows you to see what you're doing a lot better. So I mean, Almost every professional app goes dark gray. You know, it has been dark gray for a long time. And I mean, literally, our whole office is all medium gray. It's not dark gray, but it's, you know, it's gray.
Is it 30%, 20%?
18%. Ours is all 18? Literally, we take an 18% gray card and we hand it to the person painting and just go, just match that card. And so everything, you can literally color correct your cameras to the wall.
Well, that's anyway, so cool, anyway, actually.
But yeah. So it's all gray. But taking that color out makes it much easier when you have that that background. Your colors pop, and when it's gray, it's going to be more accurate. It's just a lot easier for your eyes, and it looks cooler. It's just clear.
Yeah,
you know, it's just. Looks nicer.
If you feel like there's a reason why you're billing by the hour as much as you're billing by the hour if your app is in a dark mode.
Yes.
What do you think about the photo editing capabilities they've actually put in the Finder now? I mean, I know that you need something more. I need something more. But just the ability to, say, crop an image.
I think it's huge. I think it's. Yeah. I think that you know, there are so many things that you're doing that are these really quick things that you have to do. Oh, I need to crop this. Or I need to... I need to do, file conversion. I need to do all these other things are things that you want to be able to do in the Finder. You don't want to have to go out to whether it's Pixelmator or Photoshop. I mean, and then the thing we probably have to do more often than anything else is rescale or crop. You know, those are probably the most common things you want to do with a photo.
We're going to try to get Sal Segoyan on triangulation very soon. I sent a note to his wife, Naomi, both to ask about Yojimbo.
Right.
But also... I said, so is Sal like thrilled about the automation features they're building into iOS, or is he feeling like, wow? And we'll get him on to talk about it, and I'm sure he'll be judicious. But the sense I got was the difference is it was the macOS people who Sal was working for, and they decided automation wasn't cool. The iOS kids... now have decided that automation is cool. And it's just that there was a wall between the two groups.
And that happens in companies often.
Always.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have two different, you know, something can go away one place and pop up the other.
This is one of those things they preface by saying, I have no specific inside information, and I want to stress that. But my impression has usually been that there really is like a, if something is an iOS idea, it's wonderful. If something is a macOS idea, okay, it's fine. And basically that anything that makes iOS more triumphant, anything that makes it more practical, more useful, more professional is a high priority, whereas it's hard to figure out how to market an automation feature in the Mac, because if it's someone who's going to take advantage of that feature, they already know it exists and it's not going to affect a sale, whereas the ability to get an IT department to start shipping out iPad Pros to its workers in the field, as opposed to Windows notebooks, that's a really, really big deal.
Yeah. Lori, you went to both Google I/O and WWDC. You've had some time to think about both.
And
I think you have some thoughts.
Well, you know, I mean, we can do some generals and we can do some specifics. So in general, I love the way both present. They're both pretty fantastic and get your blood boiling, get you super excited about, you know, things to come in the future. They look great. There's lots of wonderful people, lots of wonderful developers at both. The Apple conference at WWDC, I've noticed a lot more developers who are engaging and just talking to each other and kind of networking with each other, as opposed to kind of hanging out amongst themselves a little bit, just in a personal level. And this was just from my personal experience. I did want to speak specifically to AR, Apple's new AR feature, if we're ready to talk about that now, which is...
Yeah. So we played. It's funny. We were on iOS today. We were playing. We did a whole iOS today on what features in iOS 12 could you do right now on iOS 11 through third-party apps. And one of them, I've already deleted it because I don't want to ever play it again. But one of them was called Hero. What was it called? I can't remember. But we played it, and it had the problem, I think, that all AR apps are going to have when they're using the back camera. It's very hard. If you use the front camera app, Apple's made that for augmented reality. It's got depth sensors. It's got the point scanning, the face scanning, all of those things that really help AR be accurate. None of that stuff is on the back.
Well, you've got the two lenses.
Do they use both lenses for
I do believe that they use both lenses for that. Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely. And then the other thing is that you also, I have to admit, I probably have less, because I've been doing photogrammetry for 20 years, I have less problems with the AR than most people because I realize I naturally do certain things.
You like know what, well, what I naturally, the pitfalls are.
I naturally move my camera a lot rather than, so when you rotate your camera like this, it's really hard for it to figure out what the 3D scene is. If you move your hand like this, what it's doing is it's looking at all these points. And then it says, what's the pair? It looks at the speed at which those points are moving. And that's how it figures out what the 3D is. And 3D tracking, 3D match moving has been doing that for, 20 years. And so that technology is not new. Now, the advantage that the phone has is that it has an accelerometer that is a cheat sheet. So I know where you are. I know where you're pointed. I know a bunch of things about that. So that cheat sheet.
Oh, the accelerometer.
Yeah. So it says, okay, I know that you're rotating. And then it makes it easier for it to get close. And then it uses the feature tracking, which again has been around in 2D for 25 years and 3D in the last 20 years. But it grabs onto that and is able to generate, 3D, what we would call a sparse cloud. So it's it just grabs a couple points.
So it has sufficient hardware to do a good job with it.
It has, the phone, the laser's better. I mean, Tango
they're
is
showing with the iPad, yeah, though, right, Laurie? That's what they were playing that slingshot
absolutely
game.
It can definitely do it. It can do it with one lens. It can do it with two lenses. It can do it with those things. Tango, for instance, is still way better.
It has all this hardware.
Because it has the laser. It has a laser, but it is now the problem with it is it lasts about 10 minutes before you run out of battery. But it's a much more accurate. It'll lock better than what you get with the iPhone. But that's a good example of Google doing the right way to do it, but
and then nobody bought it. Nobody supported it. So they
Google didn't
out,
support
they did
it.
AR
Google,
Core.
Google didn't put it in their own phone.
Because it would cost a lot more. And so Google, Google watched ARKit, watched Apple's success with ARKit, and said, "Oh crap!" Yeah, and they abandoned Tango and said, "All right, we got AR Core, which is basically Google's Android version of ARKit."
Yeah.
So Lori, did you get to play the slingshot game, Renee? I saw Renee playing it.
Renee played the screenshot game. I haven't had a chance to play it, but I saw some pictures. I get an idea. And here's where my anti-Apple comes in, if you will. Google's doing it right. So this is the new feature that's coming in iOS 12. You're going to be able to play an AR game with another person. So I'm on one side of a table, you're on another side of a table, and let's say it's ping pong. You can play ping pong in AR with the other person, and it uses this thing called anchors. So one iPhone is sort of the host of this game and sends this information off to the game and creates an anchor. And then that information is sent to the other person's phone, which then becomes the receiver of that information and the receiver of the anchor. So they're tied together. So it makes it so that two iPhones can play this game in the same room together as if they were, playing, a console game or something like that. Where Google is, both Google and Apple have similar processes. Where Google is doing it right is that they made this cross device. You can do the same thing on an iPhone. You can do the same thing on an Android phone. And Apple has shut this down to only on iPhones. I think that's a big mistake. I think being able to play cross platform with Android and iOS is brilliant. And it bums me out that Apple decided to keep this localized on iOS only. And I understand all security issues and things like that, but we can already do it with games that are developed from Google. Actually, Google has an app right now, whose name escapes me right now, but it's a handwriting game where you write
in the air.
Yeah. And you can use that on your iPhone and you can use that on an Android phone. So Apple didn't lock Google out from being able to do this on iPhones. So they are saying, we think it's cool, go ahead and do it. But in the reverse, Apple didn't do the same thing. They're not making it so that Google phones, that Android phones have access to ARKit or ARKit games. I think that's a mistake.
I don't think it's as someone who's developed on both, let's say not Android, but Windows and Apple products. From our experience when we were writing code for it was that the other operating system, whatever your other operating system is, was just an enormous amount of work. In our case, 90% of our support was supporting the Windows platform. More than 90% was supporting the Windows platform, but it was 10% of our sales. And so we killed it. Like, we just killed the Windows side. And it didn't have to do with the fact that we're big Mac guys or whatever. It was, we thought we'd sell a lot more on Windows. That's why we built a Windows version. And but the issue is that we it was just more work, and it wasn't panning out, and it allowed us to innovate faster because once you stop writing for both platforms, you just start using the libraries that you have available to you, and everything moves faster. And I think that Apple's approach to this is less of a business one and more of a just that it's faster. They can innovate faster. They can put more features in because they own the hardware and the software. They don't have to figure out how they're gonna jack this up inside of an Android thing rather than, Google needs to do it. Apple doesn't.
It's kind of like the old days when Apple had to support Windows because it was a minority operating system and Windows
is still a minority.
Dominant.
It's still a minority operating system, but its minority is so big.
It feels like the way, and I don't, it, you maybe for good technical reasons and maybe for commercial reasons, I think it happens to be both are fostered.
I think it's almost all just, they just want to be able to move faster and they can move faster with.
It feels like the people at Apple just don't think anybody has anything but Apple.
No, they just don't
it's
care.
It's just like a,
well,
they don't.
I think that they have an idea of the world that works just great for them and works great for their customers too. It's like they're not responsible for changing the entire world and making the right. AR experience better right. for everybody. Right. Whereas it's partly due to business models. I think it's also part due to corporate philosophies between Google and Apple. Google is like, no, I should, if it's possible for us to make this work for everybody, we're going to make this work for everybody. Again, it's business and philosophy. Apple's is, we can make the very best version of this and we can keep iterating and improving it really, really fast if we make sure it's just running on our own hardware, where we can optimize the operating system and the hardware and this feature and also the APIs to work together so well that if we were trying to make sure this worked on a Samsung Galaxy like S6 as well, we can't create a really great experience for that. So I'm not going to ding them for that. I wish that they would do more things that were multi-platform, but this particularly when it comes to AR, this is something where you can create the best possible experience by getting every single CPU cycle and every single screen cycle and making it the best it could possibly be. When I'm seeing how quickly developers were grabbing onto the AR kit improvements, where just things like it looked like big screen Hollywood special effects, the way that ARKit was tracking an object and just simply annotating, with a box and an arrow pointing at something saying, here is the thing that you need to pick up next, or here is background on this piece of paper, the information that's on this sheet of paper. That's such a wonderful, smooth thing that, I would love to see. It will help everybody else in that everybody will see how good AR can be and try to match the performance of what Apple is doing.
And the thing is that it's also not bi-directional. So the amount of work that Google has to do to get everything working on every Android phone is a huge lift, and adding the iPhone is a little lift. The amount Apple has to do to, they have, making it work on the iPhone is a small lift, yeah. Making it available for 27 different, platforms and there's only 6% of the installed base that has the newest operating system, all that stuff. That's a much harder lift, for Apple than it is for Google. To add, Google's adding one more phone. Apple is adding, this cacophony of hardware and software. So
I'm a big fan of interoperability and open, but I also recognize that Apple's philosophy is working for them, and I think you're right. It does make a better product. Why dilute it? I don't, for instance, I never launch Apple Music on my Android phone.
Right.
I'm not tempted to. I have a subscription. I'm just not tempted to.
Right.
So I understand what you're saying, Lori, and I agree with you.
And the trouble that a lot of people are going to have.
You got to acknowledge this works for Apple.
And
absolutely. But that from the consumer perspective, which I'm a consumer, I'm not a developer, you know, from the consumer perspective, it bums me out.
Well, that's only because you must have some non-Apple hardware.
Well, I have friends with non-Apple hardware.
Why would you ever buy non-Apple?
I'll never get to play those games with them.
Okay. You have friends.
It's going to get way worse, though, because you look at like the Memoji. You know,
it's going to only get
worse. And all of those things that you know, it's not just, you have to, like, I'm frustrated with my wife that she's got the iPhone. It's not that she has a different phone. She has an 8.
She has an 8.
Yeah. She doesn't have a 10. And I'm like,
come on. No, Lisa's all in iPhone, and I keep pushing Android, and she went once, and she's never going back. She loves her iPhone, but she won't wear an Apple Watch, and I want to do the walkie-talkie thing.
Oh, I know. Doesn't that look so fun?
It looks so fun. I'll have to bug you, Lori. That's all.
Yeah, I'm done with that.
So Wired, actually interesting article, Peter Rubin said that these AR features are proof that Apple's working on wearables. And the proof is, who wants to hold an iPad at arm's length for any more than a few minutes, right?
Well, I think it's true.
Yeah, I have the exact same feeling. As a matter of fact, I haven't finished writing yet that has to be now changed a little bit to make sure people don't think I'm ripping off Wired.
Oh,
but yeah, that's one of the reasons why I was mentioning that ARKit demo. It's like, you look at what can be done, how much of a big improvement they've done in simply tracking objects and basically making sure that virtual elements line up perfectly no matter where you're going. And this is, you really feel like you're looking at the best way they could use code that they've already written for a device we haven't seen yet. Like they have these wearable devices in the labs, and they're writing software to make that stuff work great. And then almost as an afterthought, they're saying, oh, and we'll just like change 3 lines of code so it'll work on the iPad and start developers getting used to how to use it. It's like when Apple started teaching developers how to write a whole bunch of how to write apps that don't necessarily anticipate that it's going to be an iPhone screen, and Apple had not announced a larger iPhone or a tablet yet, but you know that, okay, they're not doing this because they're anticipating going from a 5-inch screen to a 5.4-inch screen. They're doing this because they're anticipating a much bigger move in the future.
Yeah, exactly. I think what it comes down to at this point is, will it be an AR headset or a VR headset, and will it be a standalone or will it connect to your Mac? Because I mean, it's clear that they're heading that direction with the way the AR kit is being massively developed and pushed forward, and the way everyone all the heads at Apple keep talking about AR going forward and the future of AR. You know, they're all in, and what's the next step after AR is VR, and you know,
I think it's the other way around. I think what's happened with VR is it's been out here for a while now. You've seen a lot of companies do it, and the market, I think, demand has dried up. And so I think except for specialized applications.
Supply has not been great either. I mean, I think that for the most part, what we've seen in VR.
There's a lot of VR choices.
There's a lot of muddy lakes. That doesn't mean that there's a lot of water to drink.
There's not a lot of good VR.
Most of it's bad. I mean, like, you know, of all the games, there's a handful of games on the Oculus that are worth playing, in my opinion.
It's hard to do, isn't it?
It's really hard to do. And you know, Robo Recall does it well. The one where you fly around, my son plays all the time, is really good. But there's only a handful of them that are really, really well designed and well put together. And when you play them, you can play them for a long time.
Yeah, Georgia plays Robo Recall, I think, right, Lori? I think that's the one she and her husband
And so I think that the VR space right now is not done very well. I think that the thing with the AR space is we're also not doing it for very long. So people are doing AR like, wow, this is amazing, and then they go off to their, you know, they don't. The nice thing about AR right now with the phone is that you're not trying to sustain 20 minutes of interaction. You know, you're sustaining minutes of interaction, and I think, and no one has an expectation that you're going to sustain more than that, you know. And so I think that those are and Apple's good at Apple.
But that's why I think AR is exciting, because you're going to wear it all day. Well, I'll be wearing it on the show in 5 years.
Oh yeah, and what's great about the way that both Google and Apple are doing this. I mean, I think Google stepped too fast with Glass.
Glass wasn't really AR.
It could have been, but it had the ability to start dropping stuff in there. The problem was is that the feature set people weren't developing what you could do with glass as fast as the detractors hit. You know, it's just everything is, you know, when possibility is greater than circumstance, you get action. And so the circumstance of the glass was higher than the possibility.
You've been reading Tao Te Ching or something? That's, wait a minute, say that
no,
again.
No, that's, oh, sorry, that's.
Is that Lao Tzu? What is that?
No, that's Alex. That's an Alexism.
I
that's
like
how,
it.
That's how I run the whole company.
Say that again?
When possibility is greater than action, you get, sorry, when possibility is greater than circumstance, you get action. And the delta between the possibility and the circumstance controls the speed of the action. So
I gotta write that down. That's good.
So anyway, so
I want that needle point. That is a great thing.
It's a simple equation that really affect. If you look at everything in the world, it's just possibility and circumstance. You know, and so.
For Google Glass, the circumstance failed them.
Circumstance was too high. Possibility wasn't high enough. Yep. You know, and so what Apple's good at is circumstances are very low. You know, we're just kind of playing with it. And what Google's now doing as well is creating all these little wins AR.
It's interesting because this Wired article points out that what Apple's done with ARKit 2.0, which is the demo that we see, Google is doing with the AR Core refresh almost exactly. So both companies, according to an analyst, have similar roadmaps.
Well, and then Microsoft is the one that's really biting off the whole thing with,
I think maybe
with
too soon.
HoloLens. Well,
they maybe blew it.
I don't know. I mean,
I got a chance to try the HoloLens, and it was pretty extraordinary as a device that you use just as a sort of desktop replacement headset, not as something that you walk around on the street with. So I think HoloLens is actually pretty fantastic for a single use purpose.
Yeah, and Microsoft has been really good at focusing it on the industrial market. So, you know, the people in construction and BIM.
Here's
and,
why
you
I
know,
think they pushed it too soon. It ended up freezing features because people were already using it. Mm-hmm. They said it's a developer preview, et cetera, et cetera. But there really hasn't been any progress in a year and a half on HoloLens. And I think the mistake was by bringing it to market, even though they said it's just a developer preview, by bringing it to market, they kind of stalled the ability to really iterate and try stuff and experiment. And I think Apple and Google are smart. I think they're saying, no, we're keeping this in the labs because it's a baby and it needs to, we need to be able to experiment more with it.
I think they're being smart in doing the development work that they're capable of doing and capable of shipping, because we're still several years away from the ideal of I'm wearing glasses and you don't know whether I'm actually slightly nearsighted or I am actually using an AR headset or it's a little, I just, when I went to Lens Crafters, I bought my $99 frames and for $500 more, we can put in an AR projector. So great. So give me the $500 upgrade. But we still don't have that yet. As good as a lot of these demos are, they still require either super finicky experimental hardware or something that's practical, but you have to wear a gaming computer on your belt. So right now what they're doing is both Apple and Google, Apple is giving the AR stuff so that when they have the headwear, they will be able to very naturally and fluidly add emendations to your view. And not only is Google doing that, but they're also showing off with Google Lens, which is, again, something that is on millions of Android phones right now. They're showing how easy it is to, we don't even have to wait for you to ask, hey, what is that thing? What is that thing off and to the left? And I'm going to show you what that thing is. It's like, no, I've just by looking at this video, I know that there are things that I can help you with. I'm simply going to put a little dot on each one where I have something. And eventually I'll get smart enough to know that you actually do want to know when you're during this 2 weeks that you're in a foreign land, whenever there is a big sign, you want a translation of that sign. So when the science fiction is still the wearable technology, the science, however, is the software. And we're really close to that now.
And I think that Apple and Google, of course, are taking two very different tacks. Google is the big mind, you know, helping you with what you see in front of it. And Apple is handling a lot of how do we display it. So if you look at what Apple's doing, some of the other problems with developing this content is getting the assets, right? And so one of the big things we saw at WWDC also was Apple solving some of those. Number one is metal is a big deal. So
they're killing OpenGL, they're killing OpenCL, and they're going to go all metal on every platform.
And that makes it easier to do this
from their
this
point of view. That's a really good example of how proprietary can beat open.
Because this means that you're going to develop once. It doesn't matter what chips it's all on Apple chips. It's going to work great.
And by the way, that's why Apple's going to do their own chips too.
And they're going to build
They'll be
on
metal.
The Mac, on the iPad, all this stuff, and they're going to build accelerators for that format that are going to work amazingly well. And when you look at that combined with USDC, which is their file format that basically is there was already a file format that was out there, USD, that is basically taking all the texture, the animation, everything, and being able to easily transport it. I'm going to be able to email you a 3D model that's dancing around or whatever, and you can literally open it in your iPhone. On your iPhone, but you can open it in Mail, or on your desktop, and that character is in 3D, and you can composite it over something. You can use AR to look at it. That's the holy grail.
What did you think of this UDZ format? Was that
That's what I was talking about. Yeah, it's going to be, it's revolutionary. I mean, it is, it's not that it's never
it's
existed
a wrapper.
Before. It's a wrapper.
You could have various formats inside that wrapper.
Right? I think that it's actually going to sit on top of OBJ. I think it's sitting on top of OBJ.
So it will require OBJ, but that's a standard.
I believe, and I haven't read through the entire format yet, but the point is that there's a set way to send stuff that you can get to it. There's nothing about it that's changing except that you have to organize it in a certain way in the file structure. There have been other things like this, FBX, OBJ to some degree.
This is almost as a spec for if you want to interoperate with 3D objects, this is the format.
And when Apple makes it available in Motion and Final Cut, when they make, when Adobe makes it available, it is going to be this thing that you can now just throw 3D models back and forth. And, I want to preview a 3D model. I can put it on this desk. Because getting 3D information, it's not just the model. It's the model. It's the texture. It's the lighting. It's the animation. It's all of those things are going to be coming in the whole file format. When I send you a model, you're going to be able to just look at it in Mail like you look at a photo and rotate it around.
This is bad news not just for Intel. It's probably bad news for NVIDIA as well, right? Or AMD. Apple probably do all of its own silicon, including the GPUs.
I think eventually, yeah. I think that we wonder whether at some point Apple looks harder at AMD. But I think that
they're all Radeon now anyway, right?
Yeah, I'm saying how long do you really want that to be external?
I wish you'd been here for the event because they kept talking about external GPUs as if that was a reasonable solution to their anemic graphics processing.
Okay, yeah. So the thing about that is that it is. It is pretty amazing, like what they did.
You can do it, but
and the main thing is that you
do you want to?
Well, I mean, here's the deal: is I can buy a big box. I've got some big PC boxes that I have four graphics processors built into them, but they're huge machines, and they're expensive boards and everything else. The idea that I can build one box that I just add a bunch of GPUs to is something. So adding multiple GPUs is something that we. On the high end, we do all the time. So having three, four, five,
don't mind their external, despite the extra cost. And I know it's Thunderbolt 3, but isn't it a little bit slower than having an internal? And
it's definitely slower. It's not. But if you want to use a Mac and you want to have,
well, that's the point.
No,
it's a weak solution
Yeah, I mean, what we have to look at is what is going to happen is there going to be a Mac Pro that actually can take cards?
Probably not. Their iteration speed is slow.
The hints have been modular,
Even when the Mac Pro could take cards, you had to take cards designed for a Mac Pro way back in the cheese grater days. You couldn't just buy off the open market. You had to get one that had the right, they had proprietary wiring.
And I think that is going to be the thing that if Apple wants to have a Mac Pro that is really worth having, they're going to have something that is easier to add the cards, easier to slot them more generalized.
I don't
see
them doing that.
Yeah, or maybe it's only Radeon. Maybe they only take Radeon cards, as a process.
More than once, they mentioned this external GPU solution, and I thought,
well, for developers, it's a big deal. I mean, because again, we have a lot of solutions, whether it's live streaming or 360. that we already use external GPUs, or not external GPUs, we use multiple GPUs in the same machine to power it.
Those are PCs.
Those are PCs. Because now, with the eGPU, I haven't done it yet, but the from a developer's perspective, I'm looking at, you know, I have an HTC at home, you know, getting the HTC tied up with the GPUs, you know, and again, you may not ship something that needs that requires that, but being able to build the development, you know, pipeline for it is useful. So, you know, Apple, it's not that they're ahead of everything. It's that they're you know, they have their own little, they have their clan, which is the users, and their job is to keep on solving problems for the for their clan. You know, and some things are ahead, some things are behind, some things are, you know. But I think that as a Mac, I mean, there's definitely things that I use Linux and Windows for because it's not as fast or it's not available on the Mac. So it's not, you know, as a pro user, you get used to just using all the operating systems.
Given how long it's taken them to update the Mac Pro, I mean, they acknowledged last year that they screwed up. We're going to start over. Presumably, they'd already begun the process. Mm-hmm. It's going to be another probably year before we see one. I don't think they have the iteration speed to keep up with the market. I really don't. And I think that's going to mean that pros like you eventually just abandon the Mac. I know you don't want to.
You know, there's still enough cross-platform support for a lot of those things. And if you look at the AR, VR stuff, especially the AR, and with UDZ, USDZ, you know, you don't need to be on a Mac. You know, you can develop everything.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, you can develop
that's
everything
not
what and export
Apple
it.
Wants, though.
I don't think, you know, the pro market is a tiny market. You know, from an Apple perspective, you know, it is
they
not
need
a,
the pros though for several reasons. One, to develop content and programs, and two, because the pros are the people who go around saying, I love my Mac, and you all got to use Macs. They're the early adopters. They're the influencers.
I think Apple needs to support people being able to develop for their platform. I think that makes – it's why a Mac still is there.
You know, I so guess you can they program, could put Xcode on Windows and, or Linux.
I don't think they're going to do that. I think that – yeah. So I think that the Mac is useful for you know, some of the heavy lifting, and I think that they don't want to be seen as the small computer, so they're going to keep on building it. And the new iMac Pros are pretty – pretty interesting.
Expensive.
Yeah, but when you again, as if you're talking about a pro user buying
they're
a machine,
not expensive for a pro.
It's not those numbers aren't very big. I mean, those are, you know, the SGI box that I used when I was at ILM was I think started at $18,000.
Yeah.
And the bigger ones were $40,000.
That was a bargain, by the way. That was probably the Idris or something.
Those are little ones. Yeah, those are those little indies.
Indies.
So there were, and I had I think there was a cheaper one. The really cheap one was like $8,000 or $10,000 or $8,000 or $12,000. It was the O2 little octane, you know, little O2 boxes.
That was a big deal when they announced those. It was like,
oh yeah, because it was like they're trying to move into the
SGI for practically as little as an iMac.
Yeah. So I mean, and even now, when once you start adding all the memory and everything else that you want for a pro box, there was
a
long discussion.
It's not a sensitive market anyway.
Well, again, and if you take the power that you have with these and you compare it to a similar PC, it's not dramatically more expensive than what they have. It is really a lot more expensive than a home computer, though.
You also have to think about the fact that Apple doesn't make hundreds and hundreds of computers. So, you know, a Windows computer, there's a bunch of original manufacturers that are making these computers. So you can range from something really simple like a netbook all the way up to a super pro computer with lots of GPU. So the eGPU is Apple's sort of solution. And I see what you're saying, Leo, that it's sort of a Band-Aid on top of, you know, an existing problem. But Apple isn't out there making, you know, hundreds of different computers for everybody. So this is their version of that solution right now, which is an eGPU that you can use with a variety of Macs, different, you know, different levels in their tiers of pro versus not so pro. And then, you know, hopefully when the Mac Pro comes out, it will have onboard replaceable or addable GPU. But I think the eGPU is actually a really great solution when it comes to the fact that Apple can't produce every single different type of computer for every user out there. They can only do so much. And an eGPU box is it helps expand what you can do on a Mac that isn't as pro as the one that you purchased originally.
That's spot on. Yeah. Apple is, you can't, it's hard to judge Apple like all the companies because they are unique. in that they have the responsibility and the requirement to build every single computer that runs their operating system and their software, which means that even they aren't capable of building 82% of the computers that people use worldwide, which is Windows market share. So as much as it might disappoint someone like me who really wants to see more great consumer level Macs, they kind of are limited to only making and selling the types of Macs that they think they can sell really great quantities with. And so if people are walking into a store and trying to find competition between a cheap but very well-made Windows notebook or even a Chromebook and an inexpensive consumer-grade Mac, and they're finding a lot of choices to make between those three, that's not the best investment for Apple. However, these super powerful machines that are going to be bought by people who either A, have an absolute requirement that they have to own these, like developers, or it's so entire to their workflow that it would be really expensive to switch, or they just simply like them, it's not hard to see that Apple – it's not hard to understand why Apple seems to be talking a lot about the pro-level machines and nothing about like the Mac Mini.
Let's take a break. Lori Gill is here from iMore. It's great to have you, Lori. She's deputy managing editor, Appaholic, the Appaholic on Twitter, APPAHOLIK. Alex Lindsay is also here from the Pixel Corps. Great to have you. Always nice to have you. You know, we missed you over the last few weeks because these are the pro issues. Right. I really wanted to. I said Alex will have an opinion on this.
I have an opinion on everything.
You do, but I really want to know what you think about, you know, dark mode and USDZ and all of this.
Yep.
So I'm really glad you're here today.
Glad to be here.
And of course, the great Andy Inatko. Couldn't do the show without him. INATKO.com. Our show today brought to you by Eero. Wi-Fi sucks. Have you noticed? Wi-Fi really sucks. It was great when it first came out, you know, and you had one or two computers on the Wi-Fi network. You didn't have 15 neighbors with super-powered routers out there killing your Wi-Fi. You weren't trying to stream Netflix in three different systems all at the same time. But, you know, the reason Wi-Fi sucks today is because Wi-Fi is so great. Well, now you can make Wi-Fi great again. Make Wi-Fi great again. With Eero, the enterprise-grade Wi-Fi system. You know, for a long time, Wi-Fi has sucked in business a lot sooner than it sucked in your house. You know, we had real problems in the brick house because we had a wide open space and lots of people using Wi-Fi and different Wi-Fi access points. And it was ultimately a mesh system like the Eero that solved our problems, but it wasn't a consumer product. It was too expensive and too difficult to configure. Along comes Eero, and it saves the day. No more buffering, no more dead zones. Wi-Fi that works. I have Eero all over the house now. The Eero base station, and then these Eero beacons are so awesome because you can extend the Wi-Fi, share the Wi-Fi out. It's not an extender, and that's an important thing. Wi-Fi extenders have a negative feature. They cut the bandwidth in half because half the time they're talking to your laptop, but the other half the time they have to get the data from the Wi-Fi access point. So I don't know if you've noticed, but if you've tried Wi-Fi extenders, your bandwidth is literally one half. Not with the Eero. The Eero mesh system has its own independent backhaul. That means these beacons talk to the base station and you at the same time, so there's no slowdown. You get full-speed Wi-Fi everywhere in the house. Each one of these units is good for about 1,500 square feet, so you get as many units as you need to cover your house. This is the second generation Eero. They've learned a lot in the 2 years since they came out in early 2016. They've, you know, hundreds of thousands of customers, hundreds of thousands of Wi-Fi networks, and they've used the data to become faster, smarter, more reliable. This is really a system that tailors itself to your usage, and that's pretty amazing. More speed, more range, the same high-quality, elegant design that people have come to expect. These now are tri-band, and with the addition of the new Thread Radio, I just turned on the Thread Radio because that allows you to connect to low-power devices like locks and doorbells and other sensors. So this is really a great solution for the fully automated home. Expanding your coverage is easy. As you can see on my network, I have the base unit in the office. Lisa wanted a hardwired Skype. So the base unit's in her office, hardwired to her Mac. But then it communicates with these four other beacons all around the network. And I can always, by the way, I'm looking at my network from here because the Eero app is awesome. I turned on Eero Plus too, which gives me all sorts of security and features that keep the kid offline after 10 p.m., things like that. It actually works with Amazon's Alexa. So if Michael's bad, I can say, Echo, pause Michael's Wi-Fi. The speed tests are great. I always know what my current internet speed is. It does those automatically in the background. I can look at all the connected devices. Right now, 36 devices because we're not home. That's the devices that are home when we're not. As soon as Lisa and Michael and I all come home, that'll go up by about 10. I love the Eero. It has solved the biggest problem in my life, which was my wife saying, the Wi-Fi's down, the Wi-Fi sucks, fix the Wi-Fi. You know, the biggest insult, and this was what really caused me to get the Eero. She said, well, you know, we can always get Russell to come over and fix our Wi-Fi. Oh, God. I said, you're married to the tech guy. You want it? What?
She's manipulating you, Leo.
No, Russell will do it. He'll fix it all. Then I got the Eero. I haven't heard that one in a while. That's good. I love the Eero. You can have as many Eero beacons as if you want. They just plug into an outlet. So if there's an outlet, there's Wi-Fi. I put them in the hallway because then they have a little light, a little nightlight on them, which is great. Although we have an Eero beacon in our bedroom, I turn off the lights, all the lights on that. So it's just a dark unit that you don't see. For free overnight shipping to the U.S. or Canada, this is it. This is it. Do it now. Upgrade your Wi-Fi. Life's too short for bad Wi-Fi. Go to eero.com, and at checkout, select overnight shipping, then enter MacBreak, and it's free. So you'll have it tomorrow. Eero.com. Don't forget the code MacBreak. Not only does that get it to you for free overnight, it also lets them know you heard it here on MacBreak Weekly, and we appreciate that. It's funny because I don't even – people call the radio show almost every week saying, my Wi-Fi, what do I do? And now it's just, go get an Eero. Just get it. I don't have time for this. Ain't nobody got time for bad Wi-Fi. Get an Eero.
Just like we used to say, get a Mac.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, I should show you because on the Eero app, I have my mom. My mom has Eero too. So I could switch networks over to my mom's network. Even though she's in Rhode Island, I could switch over to her network, which is codenamed Piggy, and I can look at her Wi-Fi. So if she has problems, she doesn't have quite the network I do, 6 connected devices. But for an 85-year-old, that's pretty darn good.
Still good.
Right? 6 connected devices. I actually, because she has that out, a building out in the back of her studio, so she has 5 as well because she needs to get all around the house. You can see she's got my old Eeros. Eero.com. Don't forget MacBreak. Get yourself free shipping overnight. And that's a nice thing to do for your family members, for your older family members, if they're having problems with their Wi-Fi.
And for yourself.
Well, do it for yourself first.
Well, but I mean, I'm saying, like, when you're going to, if you're going to help somebody, make sure that you
help.
It's going to work.
Always put the mask on your face first. I think that's the rule. I think one of the most exciting, okay, I actually, now that I've digested WWDC a little bit, there's a couple of things I'm very excited about. Yes, Lori, I will look forward to walkie-talkieing you on my Apple Watch. Are you guys going to use it? Yes. We have 2 couples. We have 5 people in the studio besides you and me, and all 5 of them have Apple Watches. So are the couples, are you going to walkie-talkie each other? Yeah? Yeah, I think Polly doesn't look so happy about it. She raised her eyebrows. She said, well, maybe. Maybe not. Maybe not.
I don't know why you wouldn't. I mean,
I think it'd be so
cool. Walkie-talkies.
But you know, it'll be annoying. It depends what it sounds like. If it goes boop, boop, like the old Nextel phones, that would be a bad thing. But I'm hoping it won't do that.
When you have your AirPods in, I guess it'll just be.
Yeah. Won't that be cool?
Yeah, that'll be cool.
I was very excited about that. I'm very excited about AirPods.
It'd be cool if there were a watch band with like an actual, even if it's a fake little antenna you have to extend, you know, before you can use the walkie-talkie feature. I would support the hell out of that Kickstarter.
So the one thing that's no good about an actual walkie-talkie is that each person has to have their walkie-talkies on. So I've told this story already once on the iMore show. My next-door neighbor is one of my best friends, which is amazing. And we have walkie-talkies and we talk back and forth.
Wait a minute. That's like Stranger Things or something. That's hysterical.
I know. It's kind of
Do you get
amazing.
Under the covers late at night and talk?
No, but the reason we don't is that you have to get the other person to turn on their walkie-talkie in order to use it.
Yep.
On Apple Watch, you only have to get the person on the other end to accept your request to have a walkie-talkie session with them. So if they have their Apple Watch on, you don't have to text them and say, turn on your Apple Watch. You can just start your walkie-talkie conversation. That's what I'm most excited about. Though my next door neighbor and best friend does not own an Apple Watch, so I'm going to have to buy her one.
The other thing I'm excited about that didn't get coverage is the live listen features. I mean, the chat reminded me of this. I wear hearing aids. But live listen is a great idea. If you had hearing aids that you could pair with your Apple phone, which I do, you could put the phone on the table in a restaurant and hear better as people are talking. The phone microphone would be used. Well, now with live listen, you'll be able to use your iPhone with your AirPods. So it'll be a directional microphone that your AirPods work with. So if you can't hear the TV too well, you put your phone by the TV, the microphone picks up the sound. And it goes right into your ears. The fact that you don't need thousands of dollars worth of hearing aids to do this is really, really good.
So many people, I just have problems when I'm in a crowded restaurant and I just have to lean halfway over the table to hear somebody talking because there's speakers all over the place and people talking. But the ability to just drop my phone like next to their salad plate and suddenly be able to hear them well, that's good.
It's just one more reason to keep your AirPods in your ear at all times. I wonder why Apple would want you to do that. But the thing I'm most excited about, of all the things that they talked about, and the thing I think that will mean that I probably don't carry an Android phone after iOS 12 comes out, is Siri shortcuts. This is somewhere Apple has gone well beyond what Android can do. I'm very excited about this. And because Apple's ecosystem of developers is a completely different beast than the Android ecosystem. You know that Apple app developers will build in this capability into their app. They'll flip that switch almost right away, which means I'll have access to a bunch of application features in Siri. The shortcuts features means I'll be able to combine functions from various applications into a single stack of a single routine. To me, I cannot wait to use this. This is going to be huge, I think.
It's workflow for Siri. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's going to just kind of revolutionize how we use Siri. And the article that you're looking at right now is Renee's kind of talking about the confusion that people might be having right now of using Siri as a voice command. And this Siri suggestions, which is all, it's going to be all kind of intermingled in with the Siri shortcuts. You don't have to build a Siri command, which is actually the thing I'm looking forward to the most. But you can let Siri know that you use this particular app and what you use it for, and it will just send you a notification if you're at your kid's school and you set up some sort of calendar enablement that says, you know, pick up Janet at room 105 on Tuesdays. You'll get the little notification pop-up. You don't have to say something. You don't have to command Siri to remind you of anything. You'll just get this little notification that says, hey, it looks like you're at Janet's school. On Tuesdays, you're supposed to go over to room 105. It just pops up. It's just there for you. So using these third-party apps to create these recipes, it's very simple. I haven't, shortcuts doesn't exist yet in iOS 12, so we haven't had access to it. But from what they showed off in the WWDC demonstration, it looks like it's going to be easy to set these recipes up, and then you're just good to go. You're good to kind of do your life. You don't have to command Siri to do anything. The Siri commands are, to me, the icing on the cake, because you can then request, for example, to have you can play, Spotify through asking your Siri to do that for you, which I think is, to me, it's going to open up the world of the Siri commands for what we have to come in the future. Things that we've always felt were shortcomings with the virtual assistant right now.
Yeah. This is actually genius, because it solves two big problems. One, Siri's dumb, and Google now will make suggestions like it's time for you to leave for work, because Google, as we know, eavesdrops on everything I do, where I am, what time I go to work, all of that stuff. So it can do that. So Apple Siri's dumb partly because Apple doesn't want to do that kind of snooping. So what Apple's done is they've pushed out the snooping to the apps. They let Phil's Coffee watch what you get and what time you get it and let Siri know. That's why you get this, hey, usually you're ordering a mint mojito at this time. So you want one? And that gets Apple off the hook. They also, with suggestions, solve another big problem, which is you and I, Lori, are going to create all sorts of, you know, we're going to tinker and create all sorts of stuff. Most people don't want to do that. So kind of automating this a little bit and giving you stuff, hey, would you like to do this, is actually a very good solution, I think. I'm sorry, Andy, I interrupted you.
No, I was going to say something similar to that. But one of the biggest problems with digital assistants for the user is that you have to know that it's smart enough you have to know that you can ask it to do something and it will do this thing. So one of the problems is, how do you surface the actual power of this assistant?
Right.
How do you surface the ability to know that, hey, I don't actually have to go into like my MBTA app and purchase commuter rail tickets. I can just simply say, get me a round trip ticket to Back Bay Station and it'll do it. So the ability for proactive surfacing of this stuff is a really, really great idea. As much as we admire the smarts of the Google Assistant, and it really is impressive how much you can simply understand and work out on its own, there's something, it's not necessarily the best solution to every problem. What if you have an assistant that won't figure out that you always take a certain train to Back Bay Station on Wednesday and you always get a coffee at the train station on your way over there? What if the assistant simply said, hey, I noticed that you're going to Back Bay Station again. Is there anything that I can do to help you on this trip? And then it just simply gives you all these Lego tiles to say, here are things that I can do for you. Just tell me what you want me to do whenever you're headed in the car, whenever you park your car, let's say at this garage, and it will do it. So that's not quite as magnificent, not as impressive a demo, but it gets you your ticket and your coffee without you ever having, with you only having to ask for it once. So it's a really neat, different idea, different approach toward being a smart assistant.
Yeah, I think we're just getting started too. I mean, when the app developers start to really take advantage of it, I think that, you know, tying those things in, you know, and getting to go between everything is we can imagine things, but I think that there's definitely going to be one of those things that it's just explosive, you know, that you can tie this to this and have these things go back and forth. And I think that I can just imagine a lot of things that I just want to get handled, you know, and being able to just say, I need you to handle this and have it execute a series of things to do that.
The potential's great. Of course, as with many things Apple announces, it's going to depend on it happening.
Well, and I think that is
people adopting it and so forth.
I think for all the technology companies, what they focus a lot on is software and hardware, and what they don't focus on enough is wetware.
Get the humans to do it.
Doing things that are, I think building a full featured game in AR and then releasing the code is a great example of what they should be doing, but they should be doing a lot more of that, you know, where you're, you know, really giving people, you know, giving developers, like, I'm going to do something really, really great that is really cool. I'm going to give you all the code to show you how I did it. Doing more and more of that, I think, is
Apple
something that
needs to bring back Kai Kawasaki. They need to bring back the evangelists.
They have evangelists. I think that they
do. They? I mean, are they? But do you get the sense that I always, maybe it's just because I don't know, but I get the sense Apple has a certain amount of arrogance. They demonstrated that to me when they talked about how they're designing the Mac Pro by bringing people in-house, hiring people so they could watch how they worked. I think, to your point exactly, Apple, even though it's the most valuable company in the history of companies, should really get out there and start proselytizing and working with people and getting them to do this stuff.
Well, working with them, and also, I mean, I think that iBooks could be a lot more than what it is, you have this incredible engine that could create interactive learning, you know, that's all there ready to do that. But what you don't get any of that because there aren't really good examples, and Apple should spend $1 billion a year generating content out of it. And the mistake that they made at the beginning was they actually went to the big, I don't know how much money they spent, but they definitely worked with, book book companies, but they were, went to Pearson, you know, and what they got was the
big
book companies just lived inside their own little bucket of what you can do with a book, you know, and, you know, they, that was a clear version of if you have a hammer, everything's a nail, you know, or if you have a screwdriver, you screw everything up. So anyway, but the, I think that that is, they just got more of the same that was kind of in this, it's kind of like, well, we want to make films, so let's take video of stage, of the stage. You know, there's a stage, you know, there's a, we're going to go to Broadway and take videos of the stage. Now you're getting the worst of both experiences. You don't get the live experience of being there, and you, and the camera angles are bad. And, you know, that's what, that's how film started. I mean, that's why it took a long time to get it off the ground. They're like, ah, it's okay. Once they realized they didn't have to do what stage was doing, film became a big deal. And we have to get to a point where media is not a book converted with a couple moving videos, but it is an entirely new experience. And the iBooks is capable of doing that. It is capable. It has all the tools. It's just that nobody, Apple needs to, I do think that Apple needs to pay people to do it, you know, to get, you know, because it's a risk. You know, the market, it's a chicken or egg thing. The market is not big enough to build that book right now. So that book is going to cost 10 times more than it, than it's worth in the beginning. But you have to get people, you know, so you have to, you know, prime that system by spending that money and getting it off the ground. And it'd be expensive because it's trying to do something different. But I think that all the companies don't spend enough money promoting their product.
Well, we need to tell every app developer, every app that we use, get Siri shortcut support.
Oh, yeah.
Do you, Larry, do you have a sense of how much of this comes from Apple and how much of it comes from third parties? Is Apple doing some of the content as well?
As far as I know, this is just all third-party app developers. Apple might be doing something with their own built-in apps. Again, I have no access to the Siri shortcut, so it's just not out.
So you're using 12, but it's just not in the beta yet.
It's just not in the beta yet, correct, yeah.
Yeah. Rene's article is excellent, and he says this is really the move from pull to push. Instead of you going out there and telling, you know, an interface what you need and programming it, pushing it into the notifications is really a good idea. And he says it's really automation, not for power users, but for the mainstream. And I think that that's a good point. I do hope that it lives up to its promise. I hope that it gets support from third-party developers because I think it could potentially, this is where Apple could actually, if this lives up to its promise, as I said, I would stop using an Android. I use both Apple and Android, but I would not feel the need to use Android at all.
Right.
If Apple started doing some of that stuff. In fact, I would say, God, I have to have my iPhone. It needs, I don't, what do I do without my Siri reminders?
And I think the rock style ads that basically got you excited about features, but also taught you about the features. I mean, the most important part of the rock ad was that it taught you all these things that the phone can do. I think Apple should do all ads like that.
But I have to say that's another pull interaction. Mm-hmm. And that's the challenge with pull. You have to teach people a syntax. You have to give them the idea that they can do it and then teach them the syntax and then get them to do it. And unless you do it every day, like that's why everybody uses their Amazon Echo to set cooking timers, but for very little other things, right? Because you got to do it every day. So that's why I think push could really be a big step forward where the phone, and I admittedly, we already get too many notifications. So this goes hand in hand with managing notifications better, which Apple's also doing. But I think if the phone can say a gentle nudge, hey, did you know, you know, would you like me to make this a routine? And you say yes, and then it starts doing that. I think that's the way to do it.
I've noticed that your heart rate was very high. Would you like to send your wife some flowers?
It already does that. Yeah, I hear you talking to your wife, and she doesn't seem happy. Yeah,
we can order that from FTD today. You know? Would you like the big roses?
There's a lot of potential. There's a lot of potential. This is going to be very interesting to see. I always try to temper my excitement because, like with iBooks, we were all excited about iBook Author, and it just never went anywhere. And I think you got to temper your, because Apple's showing you the potential.
Right.
They're showing you this is how it could be, but there's no guarantee that that's what will happen. And so I don't know if I can help evangelize or something. This is a future I really like the idea of. Anything else we want to talk about from the Apple event? There are rumors going forward. I don't know if you saw the Ars Technica article that Apple is going to be ditching physical buttons on the Apple Watch. This is actually Fast Company. I should give them, citing a source with direct knowledge. So let me give Fast Company. This makes sense. I mean, the biggest problem Apple Watch has is user interface.
Well, it's the I'm of two minds on this. I think it's a I think that clicky buttons have a place. I think they're a really good idea, particularly on something like a watch, where sometimes maybe you don't want to. You're doing that sort of like one-handed sneak to press a button and activate something. I wish that there is still something to click. On the other hand, I think that the scroll wheel just isn't working. I still think that I almost never use it. I use it as a push button, and that's pretty much it. Also, now that it's summer and spring again, it gets gunked up with like sweat and stuff, so it doesn't really roll the way that it did when my watch was new. On the other hand, there'd be nothing more natural, I think, than to make just the outer edge of the watch into just basically a touch strip, so that you can actually be swiping your finger across it. So you wouldn't have to engage this little knob, but you could still scroll without blocking the screen. And also by reducing the number of actual physical clicky buttons, you're making it more resistant to dust, to sweat, to moisture. So I'm sure that if they did it, it would make complete sense. And I think there would be an improvement to the product.
Yeah. They say solid state buttons will make the watch more water resistant. That makes sense. Less space in the design. That makes sense. Remember, there was an interview with Johnny Ive where he talked about how software is cool because it could any functionality could be just written into the software. But he did say that there's a certain advantage to having a button that does one thing as the thing you do the most. I actually use the digital crown to scroll, but that's because I use the Siri watch face, and so that's the one watch face where scrolling actually does something.
It's funny because I don't even think about it. The only time I touch the crown is when I'm trying to go to some app, and I don't do that even very often because I have what I want
on my watch face.
Yeah. And I don't.
The crown will still, according to this Fast Company article, Apple will continue using the current button configuration with a button and digital crown on one side, but neither will physically click as before. Rather than reacting to the user's touch by physically moving back and forth, the new buttons will vibrate, little taptic feedback. So the buttons won't move, but they'll be there. All right.
I can speak to the experience of the fake button that with taptic feedback that really worked. The iPhone 7 and 8, the not real button. It's amazing. It feels great. I show it off to my friends. I'll make them, I'll put a towel over it and I'll tell them touch the button, and they'll be like, there's no button there.
Oh, that's clever.
And I'm like, yes, there's no button there.
That's very clever. Yeah, I think it fools me every time.
There's something I always, when I touch the home button and it's the battery's dead, it feels like, oh, the phone is dead. Like it doesn't respond. There's something very like cold and sad.
I have that same experience with my MacBook, because I know that, well, it's not waking up like, oh, damn it, I'm not getting a response to the trackpad. I am boned.
Yeah. It's just like there, but there's something like it's like a dead phone. You're just like, oh, poor phone.
Here's another rumor.
The spirit has left you.
Here's another rumor from Mac Rumors that actually comes from Digitimes originally that will be a little more controversial. Digitimes says that in 2019, next year, not this year, iPhones will start coming with USB-C. They're redesigning chargers and related interface for its next generation iPhone and iPad devices, and will likely have its 2019 series of iPhones come with a USB Type-C support. Now, that could mean an adapter.
It could. I mean, with Apple's big push to USB-C and on the laptops, I do see that it feels like at some point you're going to see all USB-C.
Yeah, it sort of seems like it's been a long time coming. I'm actually surprised they didn't do that sooner.
It would make me happy. I have a lot of Type-C chargers. Although Type-C is such a mess in terms of capabilities, you can't look at that port and know what it does.
Right.
Well, but Apple can control. Apple can do an implementation of USB-C that really, really works for everybody. And the idea of having one port to rule them all is something that is definitely on Apple's side. They're also in the situation where they're in certain markets where a proprietary Lightning connector isn't going to fly for the local market. frankly, there's just apart from the amount of space that that connector might take up inside a really small device, I don't know what kind of advantage they're getting from Lightning right now. So if it's nothing, it seems like it's nothing but upside for them. And I don't think that there is a not my backyard, not developed here. Not developed here philosophy at Apple. I don't think that's in effect either. So, yeah, I could see that happening next year.
Is Lightning better than USB-C?
No, it's not as fast anymore. It's not, you know, it doesn't have a lot of the features. I will say that I like the Lightning connector better. I like that it's a solid unit, and that it's not hollow that picks up things. And I travel a lot, so I worry about those kind of things. so the fact that it's one solid little piece that pops in, I like the feel of it and the use of it better. But feature wise, it's lower features than USB-C at this point.
If you want a little microcosm that illustrates this duality of open interoperable versus walled garden and the advantages of each, this is a great example because Lightning is completely controlled by Apple. There's no confusion about what Lightning does. If you get a made for iPhone Lightning cable, you know it will do what it's supposed to do.
Right.
Whereas in Type C, it's madcap. You don't know what the heck you're going to get. They're even got to the point where a Google employee, Benson Leong, had to go on Amazon pages for Type C cable saying, don't buy this one, it will fry your device.
Right.
He actually did a lot of good eventually getting Amazon to remove the bad Type C cables. But that the fact that could even happen.
And there's bad Lightning cables out there, too. You have to get
made for iPhone and you're all right, right?
Yeah.
MFI. Mm-hmm. I think there is an advantage. That's an example of the advantage of the walled garden.
Mm-hmm.
And the disadvantage, because Type C is cheaper, it's universal. I can charge a whole bunch of things with Type-C. I only have one thing left to type. Well, two things because of my iPad. Two things left to charge with Lightning.
I think in a lot of ways, I was talking with someone about this over the weekend. In a lot of ways, I think that Apple, the Apple user, the prototypical Apple user, cares less about the device, actually, and more about what they're doing than, so I think when you really want all that flexibility and all those other bits and pieces, you really are into the device. You want to suck up all the things, and Apple users just kind of want it to work. They don't want that to be part of their daily thing. They just want to turn it on. Like what I use my Mac for and what I use my iPhone for, I just want it to turn on and do its thing. What I use my Android phone for and what I use my Linux and Windows, those are really geeky, things to do. But I don't want to write. I don't want to write papers on it, and I don't want to build. When I'm doing that kind of thing, I just want it to work.
Yeah. All right, let's take a break, and if you will, prepare your picks of the week. That's next on Mac Break Weekly. Our show today, brought to you by, as my website is, WordPress.com. Reach more customers, do a better job, spend less time tweaking and more time publishing on WordPress.com. I learned that lesson. I've been a happy WordPress customer forever, practically since it started. But when I moved to WordPress.com, I realized, I'm posting more and tweaking less. WordPress.com runs the software, keeps it up to date, does all the hosting, and gives you great templates and plugins, everything you need to make a great website without doing any coding or any design. If you want to, you can, but you don't have to. Plus, I never had a customer support team for my WordPress install. I do at WordPress.com. They're there 24/7 Monday through Friday, even on weekends, to help you if you have any questions, any solution you need. They've got great e-commerce options ranging from a simple and effective buy button to a complete online store. And they're very affordable. Your plan starts at as little as $4 a month. I have a business plan, and I love that because I can do all sorts of stuff, including e-commerce and SEO tools and a whole bunch of great plugins and themes. I can even bring my own. So I am a big fan. 30% of all the websites in the world run on WordPress. I'm not surprised. I'm really not surprised. If you're a business, you don't have a website, no, your Facebook page does not count. You don't own that. You need a site you own that's yours, that you make your own, and that's WordPress. WordPress.com/MacBreak. If you go there, you'll save 15% on any new plan purchase. 15%. WordPress.com/MacBreak. Create your new website right now. It really is the easiest way. It's easy to move over, too, if you're on another platform. It's very easy. I was doing Twit on Sunday, and every single person on the panel said, oh, yeah, we use WordPress. TechCrunch uses WordPress. Oh, yeah, we use WordPress. Every single person on the panel, Philip Elmer DeWitt, yeah, yeah, I use WordPress. It's just WordPress.com/MacBreak. We thank him so much for supporting my site, LeoLaporte.com, my daughter's site, AbbyLaporte.com, soon my son's site, HenryLaporte.com. but you know, so Abby, I've mentioned this before, but I registered both my kids' names when they were born so they would have them, and I registered them for 20 years. I thought, and they still didn't figure it out. So Abby, who's now 26, finally, she said, okay, I'm ready. So, she said, what should I do? And I said, well, you go to WordPress.com, set that up. I've got the domain name. I'll hook that up. Took about 3 minutes to get it all hooked up, and it's so great. Now, Henry's doing the same thing. He said, I want to post my pictures, but Facebook squeezes them to nothing. They look terrible. I said, yeah. So next time I go up to San Francisco or down to San Francisco to visit Henry, I'm setting them up. WordPress.com/MacBreak. Alex, you haven't been here in so long. Do you have a pick for us?
I have a continuation of the conversation that we had the last time, which was there was face cap, which is the you can capture the motion on your facial motion. And now, a week later, after I announced that, Maxon on Cineversity released a plugin that just I just kind of want to show this because I think this is the stuff that's kind of coming up next. So what you can do here is what Maxon
last
did.
Last time you were here, you took a picture of my face.
I'm still working on that.
And posted the creepiest thing ever. And you did that with an app on your iPhone.
Yeah, that's with an app that's not, I don't know if that's released yet. Okay. But we're working on animating it. But one of the things that, what Maxon did is they basically capture that geometry and we'll export it straight to the 3D app. So you can see, I don't know if you can see this. But what it'll do is actually capture the whole animation. So that it'll, all the blend shapes and everything else. And now you can still apply that to another, you can see that it's applying to a separate object. So you can tie one object to the other. But anyway, and this
let
is
me show this
movie.
Again, because this is wild. You can see as he's talking, he's mapped it to a Tin Woodman face and it's doing it. So this is like a Memoji. Only even more powerful.
Well, and it's Memoji from a professional perspective. And, right. And the reason that this is exciting and the reason I'll probably show more and more things like this for a little while is because facial animation is one of the hardest things to do in computer animation. And it takes a long time. And this is going to, I still think this is going to explode in the next, we get to talk about it now, but in a year or 2 years, you're going to see maybe even this fall, you're going to see an explosion of stuff on YouTube, stuff on, small TV, because the character animation work that you're seeing here is as good as Saturday morning cartoon. You know, and that's the thing. Wow. It's not as good as Pixar. It's not as good as, you know, it's not the next Gollum. But the point is that it captures all that geometry and allows you to animate it relatively quickly. And this is the first step. Is easily getting the data into the 3D app. I think what's going to happen is we're going to see more of the Memoji type stuff where you're getting the geometry out of these applications and onto your iPhone and being able to generate that content, you know, actually on your iPhone. But in the meantime, being able to easily get that facial animation in, this is a lot of work to get it set up. But once it's set up, it's just a matter of constantly capturing and exporting and sending it from your phone. So anyway, if you use Cinema 4D, this is actually free inside of their training platform, Cineversity. And it's a cool show of technology that I think we're going to see a lot more of as we go through it. If you think about the AR stuff that we're talking about, think about persistence. Right now they've been talking about, oh, I'll leave something for someone else to pick up. But persistence could also be a tour guide that appears and starts talking to you while you're standing at the museum, you know, like they're and it's going to be really a lot cheaper to have that tour guide talking to you if with technologies like this, where you can use your iPhone and have them record, you know, what they have to do. And again, there's lots of really expensive tools to do this. This is just the fact that it's now something you can do with your iPhone.
Very neat.
It's cool. Anyway.
So where should we find out more about this?
If you go to Cineversity, I think it's actually on their front page. And
Cineversity.com.
Yeah. And so if you go to Cineversity and you go to their front page, you'll see this video. And it's worth watching the video just to see how it works. It's worth watching the video. Just to, this is kind of a glimpse into the future. If you actually have Cinema 4D, or you know, you can actually download the plugin and
coming soon to a automatically generated YouTube video near you.
Oh yeah, this is going to be
programmatic videos have never
it's not
looked
programmatic
better.
Though. That's the thing. It's
well,
not,
it could be though.
It could be, but I mean, but this is the what's cool about this is that it's actually you being
it's
able
a real
to,
performance
a performance and getting your performance. Performance on there and yeah. And people have been struggling with this my entire career, and so that's really? Why I'm so that's why I'm so.
So in a couple
it.
Of years, I won't have to come into work. I'll just put a 3D thing here, and I can stay in bed and do
I'm
the
working
whole
on
show.
That. That's why I scanned it.
That would be
I'm,
really
I'm,
awesome.
We're working on it, and you know, we'll just yeah.
There's a news reporter, a radio news reporter, who has a sad disease. I once I read about it, I thought, God, I hope this never happens to me. He's lost control of his tongue, so every time he tries to speak, his tongue falls out. Well, and he loses the ability to speak. And they tried all sorts of things, Botox and everything. So, but what they've ended up doing is they synthesize. He's a radio reporter, so they have hundreds of hours of audio, thousands probably. They synthesized his voice, and now he writes his stories, and they're delivered by a computer. It sounds a little robotic.
Didn't Roger Ebert do that?
He had a synthesizer, yeah.
Well, he had a synthesizer, but also this is like 5, 6, 7 years ago. But a company, I think in Ireland, was using recordings of he'd done a whole bunch of studio recordings of like commentary tracks and other stuff and they built a beta version of the voice that he was going to be using. Although he loved the English accented voice. He used to call it Sir Laurence Olivier.
I wonder if it's the same company. This is a Scottish company.
Oh, could be.
Yeah, I bet it's the same company. So,
but I remember when I was talking to him about it privately, he was saying how he was optimistic not just for like giving him like a more natural voice, but also like telling me how easy this would have been for this company, for these engineers, if he had known before he went in for his right. surgery that he's going to lose his voice, that simply spend like an hour recording exactly. The phonemes that they needed. Yeah. It would have been very, very simple. And so the idea of maybe having this as just an anticipatory assistive device so that we're going to get all the stuff we need to assemble a really good synthetic voice for you that your family will recognize.
I should probably lay down some tracks.
For some reason, when you said that, I was thinking about it would be really cool to just have an app that or be able to go somewhere and do that anyway. Just do it now, you know, or it'd be fun to have your kids do it now.
Yeah. Save their voice because it changes. I was away. Yeah.
That's something so that I would like.
When they're 30, they still sound like they're 10.
Yeah,
if they wanted to.
If they wanted to.
For with the opportunities for mischief, skullduggery, or actual illegal stuff, I would like to record that to actual audio tape and then leave that someplace secure.
Yeah,
there, no one can get it. I wouldn't trust like a phone app that simply sends it to a server. Let's say.
You have a pick of the week, Mr. Andy Anako?
Yes, I do. We mentioned the beloved Sal Segoyan earlier in the show, and I actually already had as my pick of the week a 3-day boot camp of scripting that he's hosting in Atlanta in October. It's the last year they did like a conference called the Masters of Automation. This is the Command D Masters of Automation Down Home Scripting Boot Camp, October 15th to 17th in Cartersville, Georgia. So this is really, really special. This is he and another almost similar equipped expert will just again, just these two guys are going to spend 3 days teaching a limited number of students all about scripting on the Mac. This is like if Sir Isaac Newton had a 3-day conference on calculus. Like this is the guy who was pretty much responsible for scripting on the Mac. And the first day is introductory stuff. The second day is advanced stuff. And then the third day is here's practical stuff for applying all the stuff that you've done. And it's going to be very, very hands-on and very, very not it's not like Sal's going to be there for like a half hour keynote and then he's going golfing and then he'll come back in 3 days for a dinner. This is really, you're going to be learning from Sal how to do scripting. And also, I have been informed by reliably close sources that, of course, they're aware of Siri shortcuts and all the other automation stuff that was announced last week. So, yes, the conference will also address stuff like that. As a matter of fact, on the he's been doing a lot of scripting integration for between iOS and Omni Group's Omni products. And on the omni-automation.com website, I don't think it's up there now, but I believe in soon you'll see his first experiments with creating Siri shortcuts that actually just interact directly with Omni Group apps, like being able to say, you know, "Hey Shlomo, create a new action for my my Omni to-do list," and boom, it just simply happens. So I can't imagine if you are in the business of supporting Macs and automation Macs, particularly if you're in education, I'm guessing this is going to be some of the best money you'll ever spend. Even if it's just 3 days hanging out with Sal, if they did like a Mac developer fantasy camp where you're not an actual like Apple developer, but you get to like take batting practice with actual and you get to pretend you're a real Apple developer, even for that for 3 days, I think this would be a good investment of money. But you'll learn more. You'll do more than just hit pop flies.
CMDDCONF.com. It's hard to find because unfortunately Command D has a lot of other Google results. So CMDDCONF.com.
I think if you just type in, what happens if you just type in Sal's conference?
Oh yeah, that might work. Sal's conference. That's probably a better idea. Does it work?
Oh no, NFL.
Oh yeah. Darn SEO. So if you're in Cartersville, Georgia, or you there could you be in October.
Sal's scripting conference.
Okay, there you go.
The first 10 results.
I love it. That looks like so much fun. God, I'd love to do something like this. What fun is that, huh? Lori Gill, you got a pick for us?
Can my pick be looking behind Andy's screen?
That's not a pick. That's a command.
I'm saving that for the last episode.
Oh my God! What's behind Andy's screen? Now you've brought up all sorts of interesting.
I think
questions.
About it every time I'm on the show.
You're so funny. Well, we can see what's like, behind you. You're very open and forthright about your stuff.
Yeah, my Star Wars pictures and my Disneyland map and that picture that's behind my head. Wait. Backward. Okay. The picture that's behind my head, I can't get out of the way. Someone gave it to me. It's actually a picture of a elephant dressed as a bantha. I believe it's the San Diego Zoo. And it's from 1977. They dressed an elephant like a bantha.
Oh, that's crazy. I hope they didn't cut its insides open for warmth.
Oh, God.
No.
No, that was the tauntaun.
Oh, that was a tauntaun, not a bantha. Yeah. Right, of course. Banthas you just ride.
Then, yeah, yes. Banthas are just just in the desert. Riding. You don't need to keep them. Just keep warm in Tatooine. So.
Oh man, I got to work on my Star Wars, right? Star Wars knowledge. Okay.
Yes, Star Wars. Okay, so my pick is going to be the Nomad battery cable.
Ooh.
That I just got this, and it's pretty fantastic.
I use Nomad cables. I love them.
I do too. They're so rugged and strong, and they work really well. So this is, it's a lightning cable, but it has its own portable battery attached to it.
Oh.
So if you are, you know, out and about and you don't have the ability to plug in your phone to your computer, you just plug it into this cable and it'll charge an iPhone 10. This is an updated version of it. The new one actually charges the iPhone 10, iPhone 8, 8 Plus. The previous one, I think, struggled to reach the max that the iPhone 10 did. But I used it. It charged my iPhone 10 from 20% to 100% in about an hour and a half.
Nice.
So it's small, it's light, it's a little thing, but what makes it super awesome is you don't also have to bring a lightning cable with you if you are bringing your Mac computer with you or even a wall plug. Just bring this and it replaces your lightning cable, and when you're out and about it acts as a charger. So it's fantastic. I didn't know this existed until a couple of weeks ago, and I'm so happy that I have this now.
This is awesome. I will keep this in the car. That way it'll always be charged. And then I can, if I need it, I can just take it out and take it places. Nice.
Yeah.
Nomad's cables are braided. They're really tough. This one is 2,800 milliamp hours, and it's $50. The battery cable from Nomad. Very nice. I'm getting one right now. Thank you, Lori Gill.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you for being here, too. We appreciate it. Lori is the deputy managing editor at imore.com. She's on the Twitter, Appaholic. Anything else you want to plug? You got a performance coming up, one of your many bands?
I do. Actually, we just recorded a demo. So
yay.
I went to the WWDC, and I had to leave early because that on Wednesday night, I had to play a show. And then on Saturday and Sunday, I recorded a demo. So my band world has been
now
just
I understand kinda... why you're a little hoarse. You've been singing your little heart out.
I have been, yeah.
Wow. Lori sings, by the way. She doesn't sing like canticles or madrigals. She's a hardcore rocker.
Yeah, I pretty much belt it out pretty hard.
Is it hard on your voice?
Oh yeah, I haven't had a normal voice in years. It's permanently damaged my voice, but it's worth it because I love to be a front man and show off. So
wonderful. Where can we get the new demo? Where is it going to be?
You know, the demo we're not going to put up online. Maybe eventually someday we'll put it up on SoundCloud, but for now it's just going to be on a tape, on an actual tape that we hand out at shows that we're at. So
you got to go to the show. You got to go to the show.
Sacramento.
If you want
to
see Lori, you got to go see her in Sacramento. All right. Okay. That's good. Do you tweet out your show locations? You must.
No, not Twitter. Facebook. I'll put things up through Facebook. And okay. I also hand out flyers because I do everything. I'm in my 40s. I do everything like I did when I was 18. Yeah.
Flyers. Tapes. Wow. Yeah. Search for Rad on Facebook. That's the name of the band.
Oh, actually, yeah, I forgot. This is actually a different band. This is Sick Burn.
Oh, see, you got too many bands.
I do. I told you I'm in a bunch of bands. That was not a joke.
Is it facebook.com/sickburn?
I think so.
That's a freaking awesome name for a band, by the way.
I know. That's pretty funny.
Sick Burn. Wow.
Yeah.
Sick Burn, man.
Yeah,
there it
you
is.
Go. That's Sick Burn, yeah.
Very nice. Thank you, Lori.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for letting me plug my band.
Oh, no. Hell, I don't pay you. You got to get something out of this. Andy Iannacco, he has nothing to plug except his website. Oh. IHaveNothingToPlug.com. No, IHNATKO.com.
I am going to be on Boston Public Radio again on Friday, probably talking about WWDC, probably talking about E3, probably talking about other stuff too. So you'll be able to, I think I'm going to be 12:45 until like 1:15 or whatever Eastern time. But if you go to WGBH.org or WGBH News, you'll be able to listen to it live, stream it live, or stream it later.
GBH, the king of public radio. Grew up listening to GBH.
Yes.
Zoom. It's where I first heard The Hitchhiker's Guide to Galaxy. The Galaxy was on WGBH. They rebroadcast the BBC.
You know, growing up in Boston, it's like there is nothing cooler than being a regular on WGBH.
Boy, that's a legendary.
I can still hear the open. I like from all the...
Alex Lindsay, Pixel Core. Go to Alex Lindsay on the Twitter, AlexLindsay. That's where he really puts everything, right?
I'm talking about live streaming in New York on June 26th.
Okay.
I just tweeted out the link.
Cool.
And it's free.
So people can attend a talk from
Yeah. If you want to listen to me talk about live streaming for 3 hours. I know that sounds rough, but
no,
I've got a lot of questions, I'm going to talk at Adorama has a thing called the Inspire conference. And so,
it's with Adorama. I buy stuff from them all the time. I love Adorama.
So if you're in New York on the 26th or feel like you want to be on, it's free for a couple hours and you can ask questions and heckle me and all those fun stuff.
I mean, I didn't see this. What the hell is that?
I posted that. That was so. You know what that was from? Remember when I took the
call
pictures of
help?
You with the dots?
Oh, this is Tech TV.
I threw it back into PhotoScan. Like I found the photos.
Oh my god!
And that is the.
That's how we used to do it, kids.
Well, no. This is using. That's the old photos with the new technology. So
I think it
actually didn't work as well.
It doesn't work as well as the capture that you did.
Yeah.
With the phone in about 3 seconds.
I know that it has.
God, I look terrible in that. But that's how I look. What are you going to do? 3D doesn't lie.
It will after Alex is done with it.
Can you just clean it up a little bit, get some of the bags out? We do this show every Tuesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. You can come and watch us in studio. We had a great studio audience today from all over the place, from the UK, from London, from Pittsburgh, your stomping grounds, from Seattle.
It's awesome.
Nice to have you, Jeff Bezos, in the studio audience today. If you want to be here, we do ask that you email tickets at twit.tv. Not that the tickets cost anything, but we just like to know so we can put a chair out for you. No charge, but you got to be in the Petaluma area, okay? That's the only caveat. You can also watch the stream anywhere in the world. Twit.tv/live is the best place. You'll get your choice there of all the different stream providers, which may be changing. Things are moving around a little bit, but there's new and there's old, so we'll have something there for you. Twit.tv/live. You can listen live, too. We have a live audio stream. If you can't watch or listen live, you can always get on-demand audio and video after the fact at twit.tv. In the case of this show, it's twit.tv/MBW. You can also subscribe. Every podcast application should have a link to MacBreak Weekly. Subscribe, and you'll get it the minute it's available. Thanks for joining us. Get back to work now, because break time is over. Bye-bye.